Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.
So I am super excited to have our guest with us today. I met her as a guest on her podcast probably about 6 or 7 months ago, which was such a super conversation. And our viewers know that podcast. So Annie is an extraordinary person in the recovery space. As a mom of an addict, an author, a speaker, all the things that are changing the conversation around substance abuse disorder. And how do we love our kids, our families, our loved ones in the midst of the chaos? And so I'm really excited to have Annie here as an author and a mom and to hear what she wants to share with us today relative to her own story and what she's up to right now in changing the world of addiction. So if you would, Annie, just give us a little bit of your background story relative to kind of crisis to thriving. You know, her book Unhooked is a really valuable read. So that piece of it. And then what I really do want to kind of delve into, which I understand is coming in your third book, is in the space of healing and forgiveness, because I don't think there's enough of a conversation around that right now. So I'm going to turn it over to you.
Okay, sure. Great. Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here. I really love the work you've been doing. I've listened to all your podcasts so far, and I can't think of anything that they would be more than a benefit to the affected family members. In fact, there was one of your guests, or I think you had said to one of your guests in the early episodes that when you were kind of starting out in the learning process and discovery of this journey, and usually you're thrust into that kind of like woke up in the middle of the night, thrown into icy waters and told to swim for your life. And that's kind of what it's like. There aren't a lot of resources for the family members, and there seems to be more now, but a lot of this I was looking into in 2008, 2009. And I was reading books by Mackenzie Phillips and by people who had recovered from addiction. And that was great. Mm-hmm. But those were not things my son was reading. And I wanted to know, where is the husband, the wife, the mom, the daughter? Because I've had this experience with my son, but I've also had the experience with my mother. So I've spent my entire life kind of surrounded by the dysfunction of alcoholism and substance abuse and all of that. And I was just out of my mind trying to grasp onto where I could find sanity. And there weren't a lot of resources, like you said.
Right. So yep.
I really appreciate this work. So I can kind of nutshell it for you if you'd like. Most of it is short memoir, Unhooked, The Mother's Story. And then my second book is called Unbroken. And that's kind of navigating that discovery process to the hope and victory. And then I'm working on book three. So basically, long story short, I am from the Midwest. I'm an Ohio girl. I was raised the youngest of six kids, and I was born into pretty much a family that was in crisis and conflict. There was a lot of trauma and intense poverty. My father had had an alcohol addiction, and my mother had had severe trauma in her background that I wasn't aware of until I was in my 20s. So I was just kind of born into this madness, the youngest of six. My parents had gotten swept up just before I was born in the, it was called, I believe, the Jesus movement. So it was from the California to the Midwest. It was a lot of prosperity, triangle scheming stuff, faith movement, all of that. That had some good aspects. It drew my father out of alcoholism, and he had been a very violent man. It pulled him all the way out of that, but he became kind of a dry drunk because he didn't really have recovery. So he was focused on kind of self-salvation and all of that, but white knuckling it and pretty much still miserable. And then my mom had all this trauma. When the threat of his violence and drinking was lifted, the four older children had experienced it. The younger two of us, total of six, had not. she went into deep response to her trauma, childhood trauma, his years of violence, and she kind of sunk into not only a church aspect of it, but a prescription problem of her own. And back then, it wasn't really called a prescription problem. It was just mom's pills,
right?
Mom took too many pills. She was literally kind of the church lady. I mean, people would say how sweet, she never raised her voice, but she had all of these pills. And not only that, but our family doctor was very close friends with her. And he would come over to the home with his little black bag and give her codeine and things like that. So it was just a lot of early year recipe for disaster dysfunction. And I was just born right into the middle of it. Right before I was born, she was 8 months pregnant. Our family seemed to be a flypaper for crisis, and their house burned down when she was pregnant. So she moved all five kids and her pregnant self with my dad into her parents' home. And her older brother lived there. He had worked for Ohio State. He was a translator for the government, but he also was kind of a hippie in bands and experimented with, I mean, it was just madness. Her parents had chips on their shoulders from my dad's prior years of alcoholism and violence. So all this conflict after the trauma of the home burning down and the years of untreated family disease in one house. And I was born into it. So they lived there for a year. I did not walk. I was left in a playpen and pretty much the neglect began. I mean, just it was survival. And we didn't really live from holiday to holiday or season to season. It was more crisis to crisis. And we were there a year. They moved next door. And then that was a process of kind of moving from trauma and crisis to try to get footing. My dad had experienced a change in his life of salvation and all of that. So he was at least trying to stabilize and become more sane. And there wasn't criminal activity or dysfunction like that. We didn't have booze in the fridge or cussing in the home or anything like that, but it had its own weird rhythm of dysfunction. So I kind of grew up coming out of this poverty. We moved to a better neighborhood because he realized that was more beneficial having that many kids. So we were sent to schools where kids seemed more normal and they had money and we did not. And we were kind of neglected and we were sent to school dirty and we were on well. I mean, it was just I couldn't make sense of anything. And I was
crazy making.
So that was all the way up through the teen years. And I was kind of feral from it all. But I knew I was kind of intelligent. And when you're a child, you're so intuitive. So I knew all of this is upsetting and I want nothing to do with it. I don't want to spend my life like this. I knew that early. So I was trying to kind of follow my father's footsteps of self-help, do the right thing, obsessed with what's normal. I would go to the library and read celebrity biographies. What's normal? I want to find a normal family so I can repeat. Yeah. So I kind of spent a lot of my teen years doing that. I was just kind of socially, I wouldn't even say awkward. I would just say I was not equipped. I just didn't have the language or any emotional coping guidance, no skills. Didn't even understand what was around the corner. There was no conversations of this is what's next. You either get married and have a family or go to college. It was just what crisis are we in? And it's probably forever. So I didn't have a lot of emotional intelligence. And then my son was born. I ended up pregnant by my high school sweetheart, really the only boyfriend I'd ever had. And we got married and my son was born when I was 18. So then it was like everything came to a screeching halt because not only was I trying to find my footing, but oh my goodness, I don't want a child to have these. I just had these kind of screams inside going on all the time from where I came from and desperation for peace and normal. So I had to kind of kick it into high gear. How do I make things as pleasant and sterile as possible for this kid? So I kept getting licensing and working more jobs and kind of trying to make my way forward to have a home for him that was safe and clean and not chaotic. And I put him in private school and I would work sometimes two or three jobs, but still not miss a field trip. I mean, I was just trying to hold all these plates in the air. And when you're doing that, it's a recipe for codependent, whatever disaster. So a lot of years of that. And it did do a lot of good. I mean, the ship turned around somewhat and our life got better. We went to the ocean for the first time and traveled together. He did great in school and he had a great personality and he excelled in sports. He was really gifted in sports. So he played every sport, varsity as a freshman, did really, really well. But it was just struggle, if that makes sense. So I'm just kind of trying to build up to.
And your son's name?
It's Elliot in the book. And he's my only child. I kind of raised him on my own with this desperation of, I really thought I was an insurance agent and I really thought I was on the clock to cover every risk as an agent. You know, you go to a home and you look at the railing and the roof. So you cover the risk. So I would cover every risk. I won't behave like this. Because Dad and I got divorced, but we made this agreement. We will be divorced, but not divided. There won't be competition or manipulation or arguing. Mm-hmm. We will keep everything as kosher as possible. He had come from dysfunction too. It looked very different than mine. Mine was more present. His was mm-hmm. more kind of hidden behavior. So
right.
we were both trying to kind of be rails around my son and make sure that he didn't fall into the pill problems, all of the things that kind of build up to addiction, cover the risk. So when he was a junior in high school, he got his jaw broken in football practice.
Mm-hmm.
Right after that, at the next appointment, he saw an oral surgeon and his family doctor. He was prescribed Percocets at 17. Mm-hmm. And it was like a light switch flipped mm-hmm. in the home, because as anyone knows that has dealt with addiction that's coming quick, it was like a freight train came rushing into our lives and nothing was the same. I mean, complete personality change, friendship changes, behavior mm-hmm. changes, constant conflict. He always had a job and worked and took care of himself, so you couldn't tell by looking at him, but mm-hmm. it was always, I don't have gas. I need a tire. I need a new outfit for work. You'd never see those things, but he would be working, but there was never money. There was always a need for it. I mean, it was just mm-hmm. a lot of constant drama and conflict and tug of war and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
When his addiction ignited and began, my mother's addiction exploded and became mm-hmm. the parallel enemy to the situation. Mm-hmm. And so again, I really believed I was on the clock for his life and against his death. So I tried to track him down. She would kind of keep secrets for him and they were kind of in it together, and she would feel sorry for him and he would manipulate her. She would manipulate him. All of my siblings would believe her because she's mom and come attacking me. I would be sitting at work, if anybody's experienced this in a corporate setting, reading emails and talking liability limits as my phones are going off and emails are going off, and it's crisis every day. And I'm mm-hmm. trying to not snap, and all of that going on. And it just became unmanageable. And it was like that for a couple of years. He would go to his dad's house and to a friend's house and then to hers house. And then it was kind of hot potato. Nobody could keep him because it would be an eruption soon. And you just couldn't manage it. But he has this sweet kind of Richie Cunningham personality that is so lovable. He wouldn't hold you at gunpoint. You would rob yourself for him and not I realize. I'd always say he'll steal your purse and help you look for it when he's in active addiction. And that's horrible, because you have even more of a sense of emotion about it. So that went on for a while. And then finally, just through the learning curve of finding therapists, finding treatments, I didn't mm-hmm. really get into support rooms until he had gone off and away. It got to a boiling point where I just couldn't manage the stress anymore. Nothing I was doing was helping. I kind of considered, if you remember, everybody kind of used the word enabler as the dirty word. So my mm-hmm. mom would have been his secret keeper and the one who kind of kept him in that and made it possible. So she was considered his enabler. So I thought, well, I'll be his enforcer. So I'll make it miserable and I'll make him hate that life so much like I do that he wants out of it. I won't make it comfortable. So I would try to get him arrested and I would show up to these houses he was at. And that didn't do any good either. That just mm-hmm. made me crazy, put me at risk. And he even said later, it broke trust between us, because you still need to respect your person no matter what their behavior is. You're mm-hmm. still accountable for that.
Right.
And he would talk about how it made him go into more dangerous situations, and it mm-hmm. increased threat from people mm-hmm. I would confront who were then angry with him for exposure. I know a lot of parents do it, and you got to use up all your ideas that you think are going to work until you finally come to a point that you realize they don't. I get mm-hmm. that. But mm-hmm. it really, the sooner you can come out of that idea, the mm-hmm. better, because it does mm-hmm. no good.
Right.
Enabling and forcing, neither one make it any better or any worse. They're just part of the sickness. Mm-hmm. And that went on for a while too. And then I finally just could hardly bear it anymore. He had been sleeping in my mom's car, and then she would let him come stay there. Then I would threaten her if I put him out, because mm-hmm. my goal was he'll go to treatment. So I would mm-hmm. say, I'm not going to do anything more for you, but if you're willing to go to treatment, I will drive 90 miles an hour to get to you and we'll get you into treatment. But there's nothing else I'm willing to do, because you need to go to treatment. So we all kind of had this box him out plan for him, but it just never seemed to come about. Right before he'd go, something would happen. Someone would take him in. It was just madness for about 6 or 7 years of that. And we'd all try to do the interventions and have that in the home and imitate the TV, because nobody really knew what to do. And there wasn't a ton of conversation. I hadn't really been in the rooms yet. Managing all this on my own, and you're still having to go to the store and do laundry and not snap, and you're crazy. I mean, you, as a parent, you are climb the walls, walk the floor, pain, nostalgia, guilt, grief, fear, primal fear, crazy.
Annie, take a breath.
Also,
because what you're saying here is, I think, so important for us.
Yeah, this is the breaking point.
Yes. And it's super important to understand that we create this crazy.
Yes.
You know, we are responsible for our own crazy in this.
Yes. We have a part in this.
Yes, exactly. And so while the addict has their own crazy going on, we generally have our own crazy going on, but ours is kind of cloaked in, I'm going to say,
responsibility. We're the responsibility.
I'm going to change my child. I'm going to save my child. All of those things. So was there a moment that was kind of the turning point for you?
I mean, there were kind of several, but just before he went to treatment.
The first time?
Yeah, he went out. Well, he went to treatment locally and then he relapsed the day he got out. So after that, it was just like, I do have an eye just for having grown up around a lot of dysfunction and conflict. I have a detailed eye for patterns. So I just know when something's not working. And mm-hmm. the harder I would try, the worse it would get. And mm-hmm. so when you're in a situation that is so urgent and desperate, you're quick to get to solutions. And when something mm-hmm. doesn't work, you can cast it off quick. So I realized I just need a break. So I went away for a weekend and let him know, I don't care where I'm at. If you're willing to go to treatment, I will by osmosis get right back to you and we'll get you in treatment. So mm-hmm. he ended up sleeping in a dugout. And it was the same dugout that we had watched him step out of and hit grand slams as mm-hmm. a child. It heard his name over the speakers. I mean, it was painful. It was painful. It is painful when it's a spouse and your world's crashing and the dream's dying. It's painful when it's a parent. That kind of has a longer, bigger impact because it's kind mm-hmm. of ingrained in you. But when it's a son or daughter, it is pain. It's like being gutted while you're wide awake. So I just said, I'm just going to take a break. And when I took a break, he had kind of summoned all of his resources and realized I don't have anything. I have no place else to turn. So he booked a flight to a treatment center in LA and mm-hmm. went on his own with mm-hmm. nothing but a backpack. He's ended up making a life out there. He's lived out west now for 10 years. But that was kind of the beginning to, oh my goodness, this is, and you know, you think, oh, they're in treatment now, it's over, we'll go back to normal, all of this, we'll just put it behind. Right. That's really just the beginning because right. you realize you're kind of nuts. I was so caught up in the chaos and the PTSD that yes. as soon as it was calm, I would look for things to kind of freak out and be upset about because I had lived yes. at that level 10 adrenaline for days and nights for
right.
years now.
Right, it becomes a way of life.
Yes. So that was when he went out west. And then he was there again for about 30 days. He was in a celebrity treatment center. I was furious because I was still thinking consequences. He should be in jail. I should be the one getting acupuncture and massages. And he's meeting all these celebrities. And I was kind of furious. Like, we're all in your wake. How are you mm-hmm. going to learn from this? Mm-hmm. And I remember somebody had said to me, this is not going to play out the way you control it or the way you expect it to. There's a right. path for him and right. your paths may coincide. They may have started together, but you don't control his path. And that's mm-hmm. where you're going crazy. And that's mm-hmm. where I kind of took my hands off that. I always hear parents say, oh, I don't want my son or daughter to end up in jail. That's exactly what I wanted. But it doesn't usually go the way mm-hmm. you try to puppeteer it to. So right. that first treatment center, he relapsed there, kind of manipulated somebody, got a counselor mm-hmm. to think she was a grandmother figure. She mm-hmm. had worked there 18 years and was giving him money and got fired for it. And I mean, just knew better, but he was good at it and he's yeah. cute and she should have known better. But I mean, that was lesson learned. I couldn't control that either. Went into nope. another place that kind of was aware and he's been doing his own thing for 10 years since.
Yeah. So I love the way that you frame that in terms of the puppeteer mm-hmm. is we think we control the strings.
Yeah.
Which makes us crazy.
Yeah.
And
well,
it's
because other problems in life are solvable by cause and effect or that vertical strategic thinking. Mm-hmm, this mm-hmm. is a different problem. Like right. I was raised in a family of faith. So we were taught to be selfless. When the prodigal returns home, you celebrate and give them gifts. Well, mm-hmm. this is a whole different, unique situation. Mm-hmm. They might return home 100 times in a year and you're not necessarily wanting them to give them the keys to the car right. or the kingdom. I mean, right. you have to handle everything completely. It's not, I don't necessarily at all believe tough love. I believe in smart, healthy love. And
yes.
it's completely different than any solution or type of love I had been trained to believe in.
Yes, exactly. So could you just describe what healthy love looks like when you're the mom of an addict?
Well, sure. Well, I would say, first of all, minor or adult. And one thing that's very strange when somebody becomes an adult is they cross that threshold in one birthday and you're still enmeshed in governing them and mm-hmm. what's best for them. And your concerns for them to be safe and healthy are often mm-hmm. a lot more invested than their own concerns are. Yes. I mean, you'll fight for their life harder than they will sometimes, especially yes. when they're caught up in that. Right. So healthy for me was a process. I had to relearn it and I had to learn what the term enmeshment was. I had a real hard time with authority because I'd had fraudulent authority in this relationship with my mother. So mm-hmm. I would sometimes have women come along and try to mother me or guide me. And it was awkward, but I had mm-hmm. a counselor come into my life, actually three of them, one specific, great. Just in friendship. We were yeah. friends. And right. she worked in the court system in drug and alcohol court with families. And she would kind of speak these untangling concepts to me. So it was a mm-hmm. process mm-hmm. of getting healthier and, mm-hmm. and trial and error. And mm-hmm. it was basically started with not being enmeshed. And you want to be, and it's natural to be, and it's instinct mm-hmm. to be, to mm-hmm. save and rescue, to show up and coach and guide. But every time you do, I've had a friend in the room say, it's kind of like, you know, that fire is there and that fire is the drama and the consequences of this person's choices. How close do you want to get to that fire? Because you know, you're going to get burned every time. So you mm-hmm. can choose. So I would oh, you don't have this. Well, let me give you guidance. It was a process of giving him the space and dignity as an adult.
Right.
To get his own victory, to face his own consequences, to kind of yeah. overcome those things and develop his own life skills.
Right.
And interfere because the situation is so painful and dire. So you have to kind of be trained to pry your fingers off of it. So for yes. me, that was the process. I wasn't a helicopter mom, but I was very much cause and effect, speak the truth, teach, be involved mm-hmm. and push consequences in. And then when mm-hmm. he hit 18, especially when he went across the country, mm-hmm. that was completely cut off and I'm met with myself and with mm-hmm. silence.
Right. Yeah. So I want people to hear the idea that this is a process and a journey.
Oh, yes.
Is because I know both of us have done a tremendous amount of work to get where we are right now, which has been all part of the process, but the process has taken years and we're still in process. So another year from now, we'll be having another different conversation of right. the next evolution of our process. And so I want people to hear that it's a process. It's a personal, spiritual, mental, emotional journey for you. And have grace for yourself, compassion for yourself, and be gentle.
Right. Yeah. Go easy. This is how nuts I was in the beginning. Somebody telling me there's a recovery promise that if one person in a family situation does work to heal and get well, the situation is bound to improve. Mm-hmm. So I've always said that was a helicopter rope to me, mm-hmm. but I was so sick that I would mm-hmm. go do work to heal, go to a meeting, read a book, go back to him with the materials. And then it was like giving somebody a drink from a fire hose that they didn't want to drink right. from. I took all of my recovery and my skills and all of that and tried to throw it onto him. So, I mean, it was just enmeshment and you yes. just really have to kind of break that yoke and start yeah. walking it on your own. And that's to me also in that space mm-hmm. where we get crazy and try to control it is mm-hmm. where faith had to come into my own personal spiritual journey. Mm-hmm. I had yes. to develop stronger skills of turning this over and trusting that there was a path for him as well, where I could trust safety and protection and healing and awakening mm-hmm. to the God I believe in and was yes. raised in
right.
for him. And I wasn't the rescuer.
Right. Exactly. And so I personally have gotten to this space where I bless the Sam's addiction as one of my greatest gifts. And so I'm wondering kind of where you are in that spectrum, because in order for us to mature and grow spiritually, we have to get kind of cracked wide open. And mm-hmm. personally, for me, that was my son's that help for me dealing with the pain, the heartbreak, the shattering of all yeah. the things around Sam's addiction was me getting cracked wide open. And then I was like, okay, I need to rise from this crisis, from this trauma, from all of this. And so I'm curious in terms of your own healing journey and rising from the crisis and the trauma and the desperation and the heartbreak and all the things around this. How was that for you?
I realized that pretty early on because I knew I'd come from a lot of pain and neglect and dysfunction. And I remember telling one of my friends I'd been so hurt and so kind of neglected with guidance that I didn't know if I could ever be sane. And you can't mistake intelligence or even financial success for emotional well-being because they're far apart. Right. I just never felt like I would be strong or healthy or at peace inside. So yeah. I knew when that tornado hit that that mm-hmm. was also a call to get mm-hmm. it all dealt with and healed.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So kind of fast forward, because you're writing this book now that has to do with mm-hmm. healing and forgiveness. Where are you on the forgiveness path?
This third book I'm writing is called Unshakable, and it kind of is recovery concepts from, I don't even know the terminology I would use, kind of like toxic religious experiences. We had a lot of demonology in our home, and who hasn't had kind of a hurtful rejection type or weird church experiences that affected mm-hmm. them and maybe turned them off? I've always mm-hmm. say, I've had people be ugly to me at McDonald's, but we all return. It's so different when it happens in church.
So well, my dad was a minister.
Oh, yep. That's right. I knew that. Yeah. Yeah. We were there three times a week and in every type of church, from Lutheran to Pentecostal that went till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So we'd experienced all of it. And I'm thankful for that now because a lot of good stuff was ground into me, but you get a lot of wounds in the church, mm-hmm. especially if you're a family that has dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And what's missing a lot of times from the recovery concepts in church is introspection, because if you're going to the altar, people assume you have sin, or they kind of apply one-liners of scripture and they don't really broaden that to the mm-hmm. needs, which it can be broadened, but mm-hmm. a lot of those things are kind of lacking. So that's what this book is now mm-hmm. about. And it's interesting. Mm-hmm. I sent out a note and asked people to send me their experiences, and I've had kind of an overwhelming amount of church abuse experiences. And I wanted to make sure you include how you came back to faith and hope. I don't want it to be a woe with me. Right. So there was a lot of healing and forgiveness, but you really have to break away and kind of journey on your own and find mm-hmm. your own personal space and salvation mm-hmm. and all of that. So the book is really about that.
Yeah. And so to say a little bit more about your own breaking away and your own unfolding in your spiritual journey to come to this place.
I don't want to shame my parents. People do the best they can with the tools they have and the beliefs they have. Right. And so there was a lot of good things taught, ethics and a relationship with God being a daily thing and a daily walk. But there was a lot of scary, condemning demonology and manipulation. And there were things like if you disagreed or argued with something or disputed it, you weren't just disputing with mom or arguing with your siblings. God stood on their side and it was your eternity at stake. So God hated you and you were unchristian and mm-hmm. it kind of had this bigger picture to it. And mm-hmm. I hated all of that. Mm-hmm. And my mom had kind of sunk deeper into her own types of dysfunction. And I became a target of it, being the youngest and the one mm-hmm. still at home. And a lot of that religious stuff was vented on me. So I really wanted nothing to do with it for a long time until I kind of started thinking, well, what is the truth? And searching for that on my own. And then once I had my son, I got really involved in keeping him in church and Christian school because I just wanted to kind of safeguard him from the world. But then it was really put to the test and strengthened through that adversity. So basically, it's kind of mm-hmm. also been its own process parallel, but very much the foundation of what we've been through.
Mm-hmm. And so who did you turn to? I mean, I know this last go round with Sam, we found out that he was using fentanyl and had been for quite a while. And
that's a whole nother level.
Exactly. And so that's what I was going to say. It took the anxiety and the stakes so much higher. And so I've trained myself to kind of go, okay, stakes higher, I need to up my game. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Eckhart Tolle and I went to Byron Katie and I went to other people that have a higher, it's kind of in their DNA, that higher level of thinking about spirituality and the big picture
applied
journey.
Constantly, right?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And my best friend is a shaman. And so I dialed her up. And so I just kept stretching and growing for a different way to think about it mm-hmm. and to work with it. But it's all working with me. So I'm working with my mindset, my heart set, my soul set, all of those things to recalibrate and rewire.
Yep.
So I'm asking you, like, who did you reach for or what did you read that was particularly profound for you?
Sure. Well, I was raised in a Christian family and every type of kind of doctrine we'd been in every church. And then we ended up in a Pentecostal church. It was a little fiery. And it's got some things to it that I felt uncomfortable and weird about being an embarrassed, bashful teenager, whatever. But I kind of returned to my roots and I went to the word myself. My mom and I would have these terrible arguments over scripture, and they were always, I felt, used to scare me or to say the world was ending or to control me. So I would just go into the Hebrew or the Greek of it and study what the root meanings were. So that's really where I went, was to the word. And I just remember early on learning the names of God and what they meant, the God I believe. And there was a name for Jehovah Shalom is peace, and Jehovah Rapha is healer. And then Hosanna. I remember the Easter, how the plays would always have Jesus coming in on a donkey and they would say Hosanna. And when I learned that the word Hosanna means rescue me, that was profound for me, because then it was like, I could call a counselor, I could call my best friend, I could go to the rooms, but there were times it was so bad. And when you're in a situation that nothing can help you, your back is against the wall and there's no one coming, no helicopters coming to help you.
Right.
I could not wait to get off and alone, go walk in the woods or stand outside and even just could not breathe or talk. And I could just say, Hosanna, help us, rescue us. Where are you? And peace would always come. And I didn't often have a big event happen where there was a movie scene, but it's all been a process. I always call it like turning the ship around. Slowly things would get better and peace would come. And it's just a process. So for me, that was my process, was going to the scripture for myself, not necessarily having anybody else pound it or explain it to me, for myself, and calling on the God of peace that I know for myself. And that became my daily thing. I remember doing a podcast some years ago, one of my first ones, and the guy said, what's your morning ritual? And I was like, I get up, I hit snooze, and I hit the floor running. And then whoever pisses me off first calls me, that's my day. You know, I let the day run me. And I just thought about it. I don't have a morning ritual. So I started getting up an hour early and I would go walk and I would learn. I'd heard another tribe that had all these terrible things happen to it, but they were known for the positivity. And it was because they would go and they would sing and get all their feelings off their heart. So I just started getting up early and I would get everything off my heart. I did this process of ABCs, A to Z, how I wanted something terrible to happen to whoever in my family had made me mad, because it got it out of me. I didn't have to feel bad.
Right,
or A to Z goals, or A to Z who God is, or what I'm grateful for. And then by the time I came back in, all of these worries and stress were off of me. And then I'd start the day. And that was life changing. Even just those little adjustments. It's not a big event. It's a process.
Right.
That's
right.
What I turned to, was a process of recovery and a process of faith. And they've both been very patchwork.
Yes. So I think what you just said there in terms of, it doesn't have to be these big things or a whole stack of these things. It can be just one change that changes the trajectory.
Yeah.
And you just getting up earlier, going for a walk, being outside, being in gratitude, and releasing that one thing completely changed the trajectory for you.
Right.
So that's what I want people to hear, is it's not a lot of things.
And it's not a one size fits all or one thing. It's really just as needed, and you kind of figure it out and what brings you peace and stabilizes you.
Right. And so like when I wrote the 5 acts of courage, each one of those, I said, if you just take one and do one thing within the one, it will change the trajectory for you.
Yeah.
So that's important for people to understand, and just grab a hold of one.
Right. And then before you know it, you're kind of grabbing hold of more. And I remember someone saying to me early, you don't go outside and plant tomatoes and then rush out the next morning and say, where are my tomatoes?
Right.
It's a process. But because it's so emotional and painful and urgent, especially like you said, with the fentanyl, that ups the ante for everyone, because that changes things in a moment. And that affects their personality in a lot of ways. It's on steroids compared to any other opiate, in my experience, what I've seen.
Well, it's 50 to 100 times more potent than heroin and meth. So the stakes are so much higher. It's Russian roulette. And what was happening was, for those who are listening, is heroin basically got sucked out of the market and fentanyl was what filled the void. And so when you're dealing with addiction, you're just going to do whatever's available. And so then therefore you're in it already. And so I chose to think about this through the lens of, I don't know if he's going to live or die. I know the stakes are higher. I need to do my work at a higher level to be able to lean into whatever shows up. And then again, to be able to continue to deliver the message to him in particular, no matter what you do, you're always loved.
Right.
So if and when you pop out the other side of this, you are going to come home to a whole and happy and healing and thriving mom.
Right.
So
you kind of learn to like take small steps as you big picture it.
Yes, absolutely. So say a little bit more, Annie, if you would, about, is there a moment of forgiveness for you that stands out?
I'm pretty quick to forgive and rebound just because I have this kind of inner fear that anything I hold against somebody else kind of stops my momentum. Mm. I mean, there's certainly grudges or things that are still painful and triggering for me, but I try to really wipe the slate clean. And that's again, part of that mourning process. Cause like I said, I get that poison out of me. When you go through this with a child and you're kind of all of a sudden launched into your own healing, a lot of things get purged in your life. Mm-hmm. You sometimes realize I don't have a healthy friendship circle or work settings, or I'm kind of repeating traumas everywhere. And it's like the lights are turned on everywhere and you realize there's a lot of dust and mold and sickness and I want everything healed. Yeah. So I had a lot of tornadoes hit at the same time that I had to quickly forgive and get past. And then that's a process also of, even if you forgive, you realize maybe something or someone's not healthy to have around you anymore. You know, my mom and I are in a really good place. There were a lot of years that I remember thinking I'm going to end up in prison over this because I'm so hostile that she's so scary in this situation and I'm scared and dealing with it anyway. And then having to fight that off. And then the family that would get pulled in and create the distraction. I mean, it was just a mess. So that was a hard process to forgive, but allowing myself time and space and really doing the work, getting up early, I would go from A to Z. Sometimes everything I wanted to see happen. I want her to go through all the things I have. I want her heart broken. I would go from A to Z to like kind of recompense and revenge even just to get it out of me and just doing it over and over and over. Ironically, my mom had said to me one time when my dad was dying in hospice and I was going through a divorce at the same time and I was really heartbroken. Sometimes she could say these pearls of wisdom. And she said, when grief and pain hits you this hard, it's like a wave crashing in. But if you resist that misery and fight it, it's going to hit harder and last longer. But if you start to let it come and kind of breathe through it and just say, this is grief and I'm miserable and I can't do anything about it, and then just breathe and let it go back, eventually it stops crashing so hard and so often. So that's kind of been my process of forgiveness is that, I mean, you know, sometimes you can just feel like you are full of poison about a situation or a person. And you're powerless against the ferocious emotion you have about it, but you let it come and process it. And for me, it was kind of getting it out every morning, or I would go take walks for 90 minutes or stand barefoot in the grass and say, God, that I believe in, take this from me, do for me what I can't do for myself, because I am full of hatred right now.
Yeah. And
basically that too, it's all a process.
Yeah, exactly. And so what I want our audience to hear is that it is a process. And there are all these different ways that you can enter that process, create that process for yourself. One size does not fit all. It's reading, listening to people, coming up with things, learning, and picking the things that work for you and letting the rest go.
I mean, it's like fitness. No one exercise or diet plan works specifically for one person. Right. And it's not about just eating the same food and doing the same jumping jacks every day. You know what I mean? It's really a process of getting healthier and stronger and learning. And it's no different with spiritual recovery, emotion, all of that. It's really a practice and a lifestyle. And you veer in and out and you kind of get dull again. And then something launches you back in and you have to pull your tools again. And sometimes I would call that therapist friend of mine and say, how'd I end up here again? I feel like I've not done any work. And she said, no, before you used to open the door and walk in the room and make yourself at home. Now you open the door, take a step and back out. It's not the same thing. Those triggers used to come in like elephants, but now they're more like gnats that you just chew away. You're not seeing the progress. You're just feeling the trigger. But really, it just does, not just with time, but with time and you developing your own skills and tools, it's turning a ship around our fitness and weight loss. It's really no different.
Yeah. And so what I love about what you said is the community that surrounds us gives us perspective that we don't have.
Yeah.
So if we're willing to ask and reach out to people that we can smartly trust and will have our back through this and love us through the ups, the downs, the sideways, the crazy, all the things, and can give perspective, like your friend just gave you perspective, was who you used to be and who you are now. you could step back from it and go, okay, you're right. I have developed a lot of skills. This is just a moment.
And it's so important on who you call, because when I started becoming friends with these people that worked in therapy and recovery, I would have a moment where I'd have an argument with my brother. And if I called one of my childhood best friends, it was like, well, you know how he is. Want to go kill him? But then one of them would say, that triggers this in you. That's his inability to recognize nuance. Mm-hmm. That's this. Mm-hmm. I mean, so you start learning who to call, because for me, I wanted a healthier response so I could kind of overcome that. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to just be mad and be validated in that anger and rage. And I didn't want to just be right. I wanted to get better. You learn who to turn to and who is safe. Because sometimes, you know, you confide in somebody and everybody's been through stuff like this. I'm not saying I've been a perfect friend my whole life, but I experienced a lot of friendships that I had to purge from my life. Mm-hmm. You know, you call somebody or you get the dreaded question when stress is building up. Are you okay? And then all of a sudden you just erupt in the grocery store or over the phone. Mm-hmm. And then you find out that person called and told people, and that's your child that's precious to you. That should be sacred to them too. So you have betrayals like that and you learn, okay, I got to forgive you too. Probably never put you in that category again. Mm-hmm. And I got to call and control myself and keep this until I'm with safe people. Yes. And that's a process too. And I know a lot of people that go through that. A lot of people. I don't know if you did.
Well, fortunately for me, I think partly because of who I am and the journey that I've been on, I actually have a book about creating safe community. So I had already created a safe community for myself. I just expanded it. So when we found out that Sam really had a substance abuse problem, I was on the bat phone calling the people that I know and trust and have my back and love me and love him. And we're not going to judge him in his disease. So I already had that in place. I just expanded it more, which is one of the things that I coach and train to, is how do you actually build that community?
Right. And I've had people ask me that too. I'm like, you always need your safe support system. And then people say, well, how? My family's like this, or my best friend's like that. It's a process too. And it's the healthier you get, the healthier you're going to want. Mm-hmm. And that you start kind of reaching out to meetings. It's a process. It's, those things just kind of start popping into your life and you start learning wisdom. I can remember a dear friend, and people have good intentions, telling me, you just need to detach. And I would think, your son's 3 years old in bed with his teddy bear. This is my only son. He's 18. And I have no idea where he's at, who he's around, or what he's involved with right now. And I'm dying. How do I detach? You know what I mean? So as wonderful as she is, and I love her, she could not hold that space with me. Mm-hmm. And that's not even her fault. Mm-hmm. So you kind of start learning what's stable.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And everybody's doing the best they can.
Yeah.
It's just, we've got to figure out what's going to serve us at the highest level possible.
And people, I mean, they care, but nobody's going to care about your situation, your child, your outcome. They're not going to understand all your details, analyze this behavior means that is going on. Nobody cares about that as much as you. So if you think you're going to kind of go unload that on someone that has no experience with it, you're
not
really going to learn and get burnt.
Absolutely. Yes. There's so much around that.
I know. That's a process to learn. It's a learning curve.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So is there something I should be asking that I haven't thought to ask so far?
I think it's basically just finding your own recovery process. I heard on one of your podcasts, one of your guests had said Al-Anon didn't work for her. Mm-hmm. I've been to a couple of those meetings. I didn't find a fit for myself. Some people love it. It all depends on areas, how many times you go, your mood, who's there. Naranon did work for me. I know there's other groups, DBT therapy. It's really all just a process. As long as you're kind of doing something to take care of yourself and to learn and grow. I don't care if it's just a book. You can order DBT books off of Amazon. Nowadays, there's telephone numbers you can call, BetterHelp. Just kind of reach out and do something. Mm-hmm. For me personally, I'd grown up in church and had problems in group settings. I'm from a big family. When people would be mad, it'd be all against one. I had a fear of group settings when I'm vulnerable to be ridiculed or turned on. Yeah. So I was afraid to go to the room. So I had to heal in that process too. And really it's not, hey, you need to go to the rooms or you need this therapy. It's really just finding your way.
Yes. So speaking to Al-Anon, is Al-Anon does work for a lot of people. 90% of loved ones are not served. And so that's where the vacuum is.
Yes.
It's like,
Those rooms should be overflowing one way or another.
Yes. If that doesn't work for you and you keep looking, you've got to keep looking until you find the things that work for you. And that takes courage and it takes intentionality.
Right. For me, I didn't often work up the courage as much as I would work up the misery, and kind of misery would launch me to the next thing. All right, I'm going to try that meeting again. All right, I got to get in therapy. You know, I got to get a new book because I'm crazy today. So, so it is courage, but it's also misery is a pretty good threshold for needing to open up a new door.
Well, I think they're married.
Yes.
Because I do think that pain pushes until vision pulls. And when the pain pushes, courage has to show up in order for you to take the next step towards healing.
Right.
I really do believe that courage is present in order for you to take that step.
Right.
So,
well, misery can give you courage.
Okay.
I mean, if you're like, a mom can lift a car off a child.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of the same kind of thing. Have you ever heard of the book Hinds Feet on High Places?
No.
Oh, it's such a wonderful allegory. It's kind of a metaphor. And it's where this paralyzed kind of victim type of, I can't remember if she was a woman or a character, has all of these relatives that kind of attack her and they're jealous and they teach her the wrong things. And she ends up meeting these two characters called Sorrow and Suffering that lead her up this mountain. And the worse her journey gets and the higher she goes, the more she starts developing strength and taking all these treasures and tools. Mm-hmm. And by the time she gets to the mountain, she's no longer paralyzed, and sorrow and suffering have become grace and glory. And I've read it probably 10 times. It's so good to really kind of flip that suffering into, okay, I'm going to work this toward healing.
Yes. And don't you think that's the journey of life?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, I'm 65. And so I was saying to somebody the other day, because I'm a business coach and consultant, I said, I'm just hitting my stride, man.
Yeah.
I'm hitting my flow because I've done this for 65 years and I've continued to grow and stretch and fall and tumble and do all the things. And so I've been climbing that mountain.
Yeah.
And so guidance and wisdom and humility and grace and all of these things, I've walked so many different dark paths and to the other side of lightness that you and I are both able to walk with people from that dark path to the light.
Right.
And that's the gift. Yeah.
And I forget what the word was that you used, but I was thinking my similar word is it's been like a renovation process. And sometimes you tear things down and it looks like a disaster before you rebuild it. So it's been renovation for me leads to transformation.
Yes.
And, you know, sometimes things are painful that lead to renovation. Sometimes there has to be separation. And if you have all or nothing thinking like, okay, if I put space here between me and this adult child or this spouse or this family member, it's forever. Relationship's over. I'm abandoning them. All of these all or nothing thinking come in, but sometimes separation and tearing down has to happen for a new thing to spring up and for the situation to be renovated. So really, I learned in one of the early meetings, one of the moms that was there said, a life lesson for me was judgment. She said, I learned judgment doesn't pertain to just people and behavior. Judgment is situations. And sometimes what I'm calling good is not good and bad is not bad. Right. Sometimes bad leads to good. Sometimes good and comfort leads to bad. So it's really not about judging situations. Mm-hmm. It's about taking it as it comes and being in your process of renovation, repair, renewal, and it's unending. It's even in times of peace, when things are okay and we're not wanting to do the work, we want to be normal, but you're still doing that work because it's the ebb and flow and it's going to come back around one way or another. It, tools are lifelong.
Yes. It's the process of living.
Right.
Yes. That whole notion that I really, for the most part, do not orient to good, bad, right, wrong. I orient to what works and what doesn't work. And I have a really strong belief that when things feel like they're completely falling apart, they are actually falling together.
Yes.
And so that's why the beliefs that we hold are so critically important in the rise.
Yeah.
The phoenix coming out of the ashes, the butterfly being birthed from the chrysalis.
Right.
All of these metaphors that we generally hear about so much, there's so much wisdom and truth in them. It's how we become, if we show up for the work,
how you deal with disaster.
Kinder, compassionate, wise, resilient
and not
people.
Petty and shallow. I mean, I used to get caught up in a lot of arguments with family or friends or whatever and get really offended and insulted or hurt And I really just don't care anymore mm-hmm. like I used to. I mean, I care and I'm careful with people's feelings, but I really just don't take as much personal. And mm-hmm. I stiff arm any type of drama that I'm invited to. It's renovated all of that. And that's the necessary part of growth.
I think so too. And so I think about Don Miguel Ruiz's book, The Four Agreements, which nothing's personal.
Right.
And honest to goodness, if you could just get that one thing, like clear about that one thing, that will change so much for you.
Yeah. I always remember I have a really close friend whose husband was kind of planning to leave the family and they were trying desperately to keep him talked into staying and they were going to counseling and all this stuff. But I just remember one of the counselors said to him, he gave his complaints about things at home and the counselor said, your misery is internal. So wherever you go, whether it's a new relationship, a new job, out to a party, it goes with you because your misery is not this family, your misery is internal. And that just like struck me. Really, that's the truth for all of us. The situations outside of us, especially a son or daughter, I'm not minimizing that by any means because I've walked those floors, but it's still internal. Our response is internal, what we're carrying. I mean, I can be having a great day. The world is all rainbows and lollipops and one phone call from my son and I am life and death. The world is over. You know what I mean? Like it's all internal. It's our internal response. So good or bad out there, it's still about how you process it within here. And the healthier you get, the healthier you can respond to that. But really, it's all internal.
Right. And so these situations call us to our own work.
Yes. Not to go fix out there because that's crazy making.
Yes. That's the gift. That was the gift for me. Yeah. And that's why I thank Sam for this gift. And I don't begin to know the fullness of his purpose and why he's on the planet. I just know it's meant to serve.
Right.
And it looks all different ways.
Right.
So if you were going to leave our audience with one pearl of wisdom, in addition to all the other pearls that you have laid on us today, what would that one pearl be?
Oh my goodness. It's that do your own recovery work. I mean, that's so important. Emotional IQ is so far from success and intelligence and how things look and how nice your home is. Work on your emotional IQ and your resilience, your empathy and compassion. Introspection is a huge thing missing in a lot of lives. That self-awareness, but self-awareness that is productive and healthy and compassionate, but does the inner deep dive. And there's a lot of acronyms in recovery, but one of my favorite ones, and it always seems to turn a light on for people is, I don't know if you've heard JADE before, J-A-D-E.
No.
Because you get caught up in a lot of arguments when you're dealing with somebody in active addiction. And it's a lot of spinning, blaming, projecting, all of that, accusing, all of that.
Yeah.
So I'd learned the acronym early on that unless I'm in a courtroom facing a defense attorney or a judge or I'm on trial, I don't have to justify, argue, defend, or explain myself to anybody unless I choose to. Out of respect, I will, but you're not going to corner me, accuse, interrogate, or blame me and make me justify, argue, defend, or explain. And you can apply that without being a UFC fighter. We don't have to go at people. I do a lot of craft method work through Allies in Recovery, and that's about kind of setting the weapons down and picking up tools that work and doing those inner dives. And part of that is things like JADE, when I'm not going to get into these arguments that are circular, bottomless pit arguments because they just don't matter. I'm going to work on my emotional IQ. I'm going to love you. And sometimes that love involves space. Doesn't mean it's forever and it's not selfish. It's healthy. So the healthier we become, the healthier the situation can become. Do your own work. The whole entourage needs to heal.
Absolutely. So thank you for that. I had not heard that JADE before, so I will be using that.
It comes up, trust me.
Oh my goodness, that's priceless. So would you just tell our audience how they can get a hold of you?
Sure. You can email me. I answer every email, maybe not immediately, but I answer every single one. I'll sit down and do it at annieunhooked@gmail.com. The best way to follow me is on Facebook, the Annie Unhooked page. I also have a blog site. My books are available Borders, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, all of that. The first one's Unhooked. The second one's Unbroken. I wrote for a book Ohio State University published. So basically, if you kind of search my name, all of that will come up. And I welcome questions, venting, ideas, feedback, anything like that. I answer everybody. So please stay connected. We're all in this together.
We are. We absolutely are. And I thank you so much for your energy you know, all that you bring to the table, perseverance, these pearls of wisdom that you shared with us today. And man, you are a force in this world to elevate all of us. Yes, exactly. And I am eternally grateful for this time that we've had. And I'm looking forward to another conversation in the future when your book comes out.
Ah, for sure. I really appreciate you as well. And again, we're in this together. So I'm happy to partner with you anytime.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. God bless.
God bless. Bye. Take care. Bye.
Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.